they exist mm-hmm. on a continuum together, and they inform one another.
So how does clowning transform the superficial silliness into that deeper meaning or exploration, or how does it do that?
Sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah.
So I'll just say that right now.
That's not what it's all about.
Sometimes it doesn't. You know, a lot of people, the first thing that they'll think of when they think of the clown is like the circus clown, the birthday party clown, the clown magician hybrid who's there to entertain children and pull, you know, colored scarves out of their sleeves and whatever. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, is there a lot of deeper meaning there? Maybe some people find it. That's not really what my focus is on. Yeah. But often the clowning that I work with and look at is they're really taking the context of our society, the context of our cultures, the context of what it means to be human, what it means to be human and fail at stuff, what it means to be human and not be good at things, what it means to be human and get slapped in the face by the person that you love, you know, and all these really important moments or things that we are so habituated to in our day-to-day lives that we can't even see anymore.
Right.
Like how ludicrous some of the rules that we follow are. The clown is the like sociologist of our lives all the time, looking for these things where I go, whoa, wait, why have we all just accepted this? This is mm-hmm. weird. This is crazy. And then make silliness out of it so that we can laugh. And in laughing, we then go, oh, wait a second. You're right. Like, whereas if they got up on a soapbox and said to us, don't you know that you're being ridiculous and blah, 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 we might, our reaction might be, oh, stop preaching at me. I don't want to hear it, because we have enough of that in our lives. People telling us what to think and what to do. One of the key things for me about clowns is that, or at least the approach to clown that I take, is that it doesn't tell you what to do, doesn't tell you what to think. It says, here's some stuff. Here's some possibilities. I want to open up possibilities for different kinds of thinking, for creativity. And humor and silliness are really, they rely on creativity. We cannot have them without being creative. And that, for me, is at the core of what the clown does.
So you talk a bit, you use the term clowning as a scholarly methodology and about being a clown scholar. So what do you mean by that? And how does that translate into what you'll be doing in your research?
Yeah, so this really came out of the research that I was doing, where I was noticing that what existed...
What research was that?
Well, just in working on my dissertation, okay. Reading books that existed right. about clown, finding what was already, you know, doing that survey of the landscape, what's yep. already here.
Yep.
And what I found in that was that there was a lot of stuff from an anthropological perspective, where it's like the clowns of this culture, and it was still very... very academic, very right. scholarly, very like, we can talk about these kinds of humor that they use. We can categorize those.
Right.
And it was, you know, somewhat clinical, in a certain kind of way. It was really taking the creativity out of it and saying, we can just take the methodologies that we already have and apply them to this subject matter of clown.
Right.
And I was like, okay, that's fine. That's interesting. But that's not what I want to do at all.
Mm-hmm.
What I want to do is be a clown. I want to be a clown. I want to be a performer. I want to clown my dissertation. I want to, you know, take what I know from that realm and have it really impact. Because I think that that's what clowns want to do, is they want to transgress those boundaries. And they want to say, okay, well, now I'm a clown in the academy. What am I? How do I do that? I want my methodology to be informed by my subject matter. So I don't want to be a scholar of clown who just writes about clown as a scholar in the ways that scholars have always written about other things. I want to say, okay, as a clown coming into the academy, how does that shift the way that I can do my work? How does that shift the way I research? How does that shift the way I write? How does that shift the way I think? And there was a second part to your question that I've forgotten now, but that's how I understand being a clown scholar as opposed to being a scholar of clown.
I guess it was just about the scholarly methodology.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And so then not just applying a methodology that can just go for any kind of thing, but really saying, okay, so as a clown, what does that tell me? What do the rules of the training that I've done, which rules is in scare quotes, which you can't
yeah.
see over the radio, but, you know, what are the rules of clowning? What is this tradition, what does this performance idea give me as a way to approach my work, as opposed to just going, well, here's some approach that someone else came up with, and I'll just apply that to writing up a survey of clowns.
Okay, you also talk about clowning and education, and I gather you've done some educating as a clown?
Yeah. In a few ways. Yeah. One of them being that everything I do is a clown, because that's who I am. So
you are a clown?
Doing this interview as a clown right now. I don't know if you noticed, but this is me clowning.
Excellent.
Oh my goodness. Everybody's freaking out now. it's not scary. It's okay. But yeah, so I've done that. But I've definitely thought about how in my teaching and in workshops that I've given, how the same kind of thing, how the approach that I understand from how I perform, follow the impulse, be honest, break the rules mm-hmm. is a rule of clown. Yeah. Break the rules is a rule. How do those things give me material from which to teach, from which to take any subject matter and go, okay, how am I going to follow the impulse around this when I get in the classroom? How am I going to listen to my students and then surprise them and surprise myself and let them surprise me? So those active kinds of questioning about, you know, this as a way of approaching things is absolutely what I do always.
Right.
Yeah.
So one other thing I wanted to touch on, and it's significant enough to be in your working title or subtitle, is the concept of ethical transgression in clowning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I became super fascinated by ethics when I was writing my comprehensive exams, and I actually started on a bit of a possibly red herring path of researching a bunch of Emmanuel Levinas's philosophy of ethics, mm-hmm. which was very interesting because he talks about the face and the encounter with the face, and it's very metaphorical and French and philosophical and all that stuff. But part of why I became really interested in that is that the training tradition that I've done involves creating masks. And that's how you come to your clown, is through making masks and masking. But there are masks that are intended to reveal something about you, not to hide something about you. So that's quite a shift in the thinking about masks. So I thought, okay, face mask, I'm interested. Let's see what happens here. But really what I could have written a dissertation about clowning and Levinasian ethics, but I'm not doing that. Yeah. But what's come out of that is that a lot of the scholarship that exists about clown talks about whether clown is subversive. Does it challenge our culture? Does it subvert our norms and our expectations? Or is it conservative? Does it show us the rule in order to make us see that when you break the rules, you get a pie in the face, and so everyone should really just obey? And there's really, you know, compelling discussions about both of those things. I argue that clowning is transgressive. It transgresses the boundaries. It tests the waters. It puts its toe on the line and then jumps over it a little bit and then jumps back. It's not subversive or conservative. It doesn't try to be either of those things at its core from the approach that I take to it. But it opens up the possibility that we might be, as the audience. We might see it and choose to subvert things, maybe a little bit, maybe a lot. We might see it and choose to go, no, that's a good rule. We should keep that rule. That rule keeps us safe. Yeah. So it gives us that possibility, that suggestion, rather than doing anything itself and saying, this is how you should be. And in that transgressiveness, I think there is a real, really important idea about ethics, about how we operate with each other, about how we create possibilities for each other. And I just think that ethics is a really interesting concept to apply to clowns who are often very, like, violent in their performances, often very lewd and rude and crude and all of those rhyming words in their performances, because ethics is not something that you would think of when you think of clown. But I do think that in opening up those possibilities, there's something about ethics and an ethical relationship that is created with the audience, because the clown is also oriented towards the audience, listening to the audience, having whatever the audience's reactions are change what they're doing. And that's an ethical relationship that exists. So that's a whole other area that I'm playing around with and curious about, and maybe it'll be my first book.
Excellent. So how did you get into clowning in the first place? What drew you to it?
I don't have a very good answer to that. Well, I do and I don't. I got into clowning because I just couldn't not get into clowning. Somehow there was something in me that I was like, that's a thing I have to do. But right before I started my undergrad, I went to an improv camp in Regina, Saskatchewan. And there was a man there, and he did a half-day workshop on clown. And I went outside and put on the red nose and put on a hat and came in. And the instruction was to connect with every person in the room. So I was doing that, and a big smile on my face, and he came up to me and he said, "You have a beautiful smile, but you're hiding behind it." And I cried for the rest of the day. I wasn't particularly sad at a certain point, but I just could not, like, it was just water. It was like someone had turned on the faucet in my eyes, and I could not stop crying. And he said to me, "When I was clowning, I cried for a year. So when I was doing the clown training, I cried for a year. So don't feel bad." And I was like, there's something here that I have to do more of because it's insane and I don't understand it. And, so then at the end of my undergraduate degree, I took myself to the clown farm on Manitoulin Island, which is now called the Manitoulin Conservatory for Creation and Performance, and did Baby Clown with John Turner, who is, one of the more famous clowns in Canada. He performs with Mump and Smoot, and he's my clown dad. And, yeah, did his workshop and just have not been able to stop ever since. And I don't know if it's the fact that my great grandfather was a hobo clown or what there is there that was calling to me, but there was definitely something that I was just like, it was never even a question in my mind. I was like, I'm just going to go to the clown farm. That's the thing I have to do now. So yeah.
Do you have a particular character you use or many?
Well, that's kind of a complicated question, even though it seems simple. John Turner would say, how many actors do you have? You are one actor. So you are one clown. You don't have multiple clowns, just as you are one actor. But the clown can play multiple characters, just like the actor can play multiple characters. So I absolutely play many different characters for many different pieces. I have one sort of core clown character that I use a lot that is named Murgatroy. My great-grandfather was Aloysius Murgatroy as a clown, so I'm Murgatroy. But every time you put on the red nose or every time you go to clown, it's different, even if you think it's going to be the same.
Now, you alluded to this a little bit earlier when you were talking. When you go to do your defense, are you going to be in costume and...
I don't know. When I did my comprehensive exams, I wrote two papers and did a performance, which I did wear the red nose for that performance, and I was in costume, and I was absolutely a character, and I was actually a really fun character to be. And I may do that for my defense. I think at least part of my defense will involve that. Whether the whole thing will be that, I don't know. But whether or not I am in costume, I will absolutely be clowning.
And do you have a good idea of what you're going to be writing yet, or is it still there's an exploration to go yet?
Well, it's always an exploration.
Because you're sort of at the point of proposing your topic at this point, right?
I'm at the point of writing now, okay. But it's always it's an exploration in writing at this point,
right.
Which is totally in keeping with my methodology that I write, and as I write, I follow the impulse and I figure things out and I go, oh, now this is this part and all that jazz. It's absolutely a performance of writing. But part of my current idea is that I'm going to be taking aspects of the choose your own adventure novel genre and writing my dissertation in that way.
Well, I look forward to reading it. We'll have to have you back when you're closer to being finished.
Absolutely. That'd be
Thanks
great.
So much for coming in and talking to us today.
Thank you.
Julia Lane is a clown who's doing her PhD at Simon Fraser University on clowns and clowning. She was speaking with CJSF Radio's Magnus Tewald.
Can you hear that? That radio is all about you. You, the listener. It's thanks to you that CJSF 90.1 FM is able to provide diverse programming to best fit your ears.
Hello, I'm Madeline Taylor. You're listening to a documentary produced for CJSF 90.1 FM's Making Time for Radio project. This is I Am a Fruit Tree.
This is my island in the sun, where my people have toiled since time begun. I may sail on many a sea, her shores will always be home to me.
Simon Fraser University has a bit of a reputation. It's known to be dark. The architecture is often compared to a prison, and everyone complains about the commute. Because we all commute, it's hard to make friends on the mountain. As a student, it's easy to let this stereotype dictate your experience. We fall into the tyranny of the urgent. It's tempting to plug in, power through, and ignore the world around you. Thankfully, there are characters at SFU who break this mold every day.
I'm Shiraz Ramji. I was born in Tanzania, East Africa, on 10th December 1948. At present, I'm 66 years old. That is about 24,000 days, because I love to count my age in days, and I can celebrate my birthday every day. I'm an educator. I'm trained as a teacher and also as a gerontologist, and I call myself a justice-friendly pacifist.
Shiraz is very well known at SFU for a few different reasons. He has lectured, worked, and studied all over campus since 1994. I first met Shiraz when I was a student. He was standing in a main concourse with a smile, giving out copies of his poetry. He wears sports clothes emblazoned with SFU logos and walks like he's late for something. What is striking about him is his lack of pretense. He doesn't expect anything from you when he offers his poetry. It's simply an open invitation to engage. I found this so unusual and couldn't quite figure out what his motivation was. As it turns out, Shiraz is a peace activist. He told me he's been writing poetry since he was a young boy. He calls it part of his activism and uses poetry to start conversations and spread his message of justice-friendly peace.
It was mostly grade 5 or 6 somewhere where the teacher said, "You speak like a poet." I didn't know what he meant, but he says, "Write whatever you're speaking." And he would read it and he said, "This is poetry and you should write it all the time." One day I realized the price of photocopier at my student union was 4 cents. So I said, "Oh, I can afford that." So I said, "Okay, I'll spend $2 every day for my poetry." So I started printing them. And then I started sharing them. That was about 12 years ago.
Shiraz doesn't only do this at SFU. He approaches people in every part of his daily life.
That's always a challenge, whom I should ask. But sometimes it can be like this morning. There was a woman on the SkyTrain. She was reading about elementary educators. So I said, "Oh, I am an educator." So I asked her, "Do you read poetry and where do you study?" And I said, "I write poetry." So I gave her one. So it depends. If I know, like SFU students, is very easy. So I just tell them, "I write poetry. Do you read poetry?" And then they say yes. So I said, "Take one." And if they don't want it, then I say, "Thank you. Okay, next." But even if I didn't have poetry, I would just talk to people. So that has always been my lifestyle.
Back at SFU, Shiraz took me around to some of his favorite parts of campus. On this little walking tour, I discovered that homemade hummus is another tool he uses to connect.
Hi, here she is. Hi, Sarah. How are you?
Hello, Shiraz.
How are you?
I'm doing very well.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so nice to see you.
Nice. I'm thinking of your ice cream all the time.
Oh, I love it.
So my name is Sarah Manassian, and I'm the fitness programmer at SFU Recreation. When I think of Shiraz, I just think of this warm, smiling guy. He would come into the fitness center, and he'd always bring us pita and homemade hummus. And it was staffs, like, would get excited about, like, "Oh, it's Sunday, Shiraz is coming in. He's going to bring his, like, pita and homemade hummus." And we just loved that. That was probably one of my fondest memories, because it would happen every weekend, like, without stop. And I think that kind of made our fitness center more of a community, too, because people would actually come in on the weekends because they knew Shiraz was going to come to bring pita and hummus, and they'd come in on the weekends, so we'd all sit around and eat the hummus that Shiraz would bring.
He got this reaction constantly. What I wanted to know was what in his life led Shiraz to be so open with his community. After getting to know him better, I started to understand the root of his activism.
Well, you see, when I grew up in Tanzania, I was born in 1948, so I started schooling in 54. And so it was still part of British colony, and so you see all the racism and segregation of all the different racial groups and so on. So you knew what was colonialism, what is dictatorship, and you hear about all the wars and stuff like that. There were schools which were for European settlers, and then there were Asian schools, and there were African schools. Yeah, like even the buses, they had segregated place. You had to like you got the movies, you had to stand up because you had to sing the God Save the King and stuff like that. So we all knew that. And the whole glorification of Britain, how good it is. And it was legally that way, but it, so some people assimilated with the whole thing and accepted their second-class status. I wasn't very keen on that. So it was there all the time.
Tanzania achieved independence from British colonial rule in 1961. To the south, Mozambique was under Portuguese colonial rule. They endured a decade of anti-colonial struggle, followed by a civil war through the 1970s and 80s. In the 1970s, Shiraz taught in Tanzania. There, he supported the African Liberation Movement and its activists.
It was part of the anti-colonial struggle in Tanzania itself. We were quite influenced by Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and Angela Davis. So it was at the global level as well as local level, there was the whole issue of anti-apartheid.
These experiences of colonial violence, segregation, and oppression have made Shiraz very aware of the dangers of focusing on difference.
I mean, I met a lot of the present and the past leaders of South Africa or Mozambique and so on. So they would come to our school and give a talk. So it has been very much part of my struggle, yeah.
By the early 1990s, after decades of working in education, in medical research, in public health, and in refugee advocacy in East Africa, Shiraz was looking for a change. Both of his parents had passed away, and his partner was killed in a bicycle accident while studying in London.
Well, I was in Africa at that time, and she was finishing her master's in nutrition. And that's when it happened. So we were studying together at London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. So I got the news from family and so on of that happened, because she was going to join me. So that was quite tragic. But then I didn't know what to tell people because I'd moved from Tanzania to Zimbabwe. So they didn't know her, right? So it was very hard to tell people. So that was on time when I was on my own. At that level, I'm more of a private person. Like, I wouldn't talk much about these things, generally, unless people ask me. So when it came to 94, my mission was at least to be involved with anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa, and then independence came in April 94. Mother had passed, my father had also passed in Africa. After the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa was become more independent struggles, right, I wanted a break. And my sister was very ill, so I came to Canada.
Shiraz's transition to Canada was eased by his entry into community life at SFU. A student and an educator for his whole life, he was comfortable at school.
So here is our library. So this is what I call the holy place, the holy land, SFU holy land. For everybody.
Shiraz talks a lot about globalizing friendship and how this can be done through sharing food with your community. Food was a central theme in all of the conversations I had with Shiraz. This is Celeste. She taught Shiraz when he took a movement class at SFU.
There is an unforgettable story. Every student in the class is required to teach the rest of the class a dance. It could be a circle dance, a folk dance, but they have to make it up from scratch. Shiraz taught us a dance called the hummus dance. It was like a group dance around food globalization, and we danced the hummus, we made the hummus through dance. The joy that he brought to this piece and the love that he brought to this piece was so truly moving.
Shiraz doesn't believe in the idea of strangers. He thinks it allows for fear and separation.
Because I don't have many family members, so I just interact with people as if they are part of the family. Mm-hmm. So when I'm going in the morning exercise, I'm feeling I'm with the community. And so it's a way to break the barrier of being lonely or isolated.
To be honest, I don't know what the words are for it. I feel a feeling when I think of Shiraz. I think maybe the thing that's different about him is he'll engage anybody and everybody. He's just so welcoming. He's so open. He'll come up, he'll give you a hug, he'll speak smiles. Have you read my poetry lately? Here's what's going on. Do you want some hummus? I'm going to bring you some food. Like, it's every time that you see him.
As I said, I always want to know first to create that community and make people not be afraid of me or anybody else, but also to hear stories of people in terms of not necessarily private stories, but how do they look at life and how do they respond to people like me. So it gives me a feeling that there are many people who want to create that community, but somebody has to start. Almost every case, I'm the one who starts, and then the ball starts rolling.
I love the sense of his deep curiosity for life. To me, that's what SFU was all about. Now I look around at SFU and I see them all. They look absolutely, everyone looks bored to death. You get Shiraz walking through here. He just has a love of life. And you know, it doesn't even need a cell phone.
So it turns out that Shiraz isn't well known at SFU because of his longevity. It's because he reminds people of what they really want from campus. Community and a sense of belonging.
SFU is a happy place, and it's also a place with some challenges. Happiness in a sense, there's a diversity of people. It can be sadness because the education system, so a lot of education is very Eurocentric. And there are a lot of slogans like critical learning or critical thinking, but essentially it's more conformist education. So it can be challenging for you. I normally consider every person is a fruit tree, so I said just enjoy the fruit.
Why a fruit tree?
Well, I was surrounded. I grew up with so many fruit trees. Papayas grow in 9 months. I used to plant a lot of fruit trees. And I think it's a universal food. There's no recipe for fruit trees. It's just fruit. So I thought as a global citizen, it fits in my narrative.
What does community mean to you?
Community is like what I call the fruit salad, right? Where you have a mixture of everybody around. So it's much of a collective experience. I mean, there are collective experience in SFU, for example. It's a community, right?
His outlook is contagious. But here's the thing. What is a community? A community is a group of people with something in common, but it's often described as a sense. You feel a sense of community. It's not something that geographic locations just have on their own. Shiraz's approach is to make every space into a community.
I believe we all have the capacity to touch into something that is invisible, that is greater than us, on however you articulate it. But it is a love that infuses far beyond the imagination and far beyond our daily living, because our daily living is fraught with so many difficulties. And I think Shiraz has probably had experiences enough to have to empty himself, where he then is tapped into this greater source of love. And I'm not going to articulate certain labels around that, but I believe he embodies love.
I tell people, I believe that I'm not the only Shiraz in the world. There are many people, Shiraz in the world. And, for example, I can relate to you because I see Shiraz in you and you see yourself in me, right? So don't assume you're alone.
His poetry is not only in print, it's the impression he leaves on people. His embodiment of the fruit tree allows him to connect and create openness and curiosity in the people he meets. He makes eye contact, simple conversation, and impacts SFU by building community through the simple act of constant and unapologetic engagement.
That's what I tell people. Take your part. If you need help, come and have a tea with me.
Well, on that note, can you share a poem or two with us?
Yeah, okay, I'll share with you the one, my favorite one, which is my autobiography of as a child. It's called We Are Mother Earth. I am a fruit tree. I am a fruitful tree. I am a banana tree. I grow bananas shaped like human lips to share and tell stories with my global friends. I am a cherry tree. I grow cherries shaped like human eyes.
This documentary was produced with the support and assistance of CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia, and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. I would also like to thank Shiraz Ramji, Celeste Snober, Sarah Manassian, and Victoria Haraway for their voices and stories.
Her shores will always be home to me. Oh, I.
Radio Goethe. Modern German music at its best. Every Wednesday afternoon at 2 p.m. CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby.
This is Germany calling.
This is Radio Goethe.